to think that, you know, seven smart people on the seventh floor of the State Department are the answer to this is a fundamental misunderstanding of the nature of how you advocate for America's interests in the world.
Welcome to Foreign Policy. I'm Sharon Weinberger, Executive Editor for News, and you're listening to the ER. I'm in Washington, D.C. today, and I'm joined in the studio by Tom Countryman and John Finer. Tom is a career diplomat who most recently served as Acting Undersecretary for Arms Control and International Security. John was Chief of Staff and Director of Policy Planning for Secretary John Kerry at the State Department. And by phone, we have Corey Shockey, a research fellow at the Hoover Institution. She previously served in the State Department, National Security Council, and the Department of Defense. We're also joined by FP's Robbie Gramer and Dan DeLuce. Robbie covers the State Department for FP, and Dan is the Chief National Security Correspondent. ER nerds, we love hearing from you. If you have episode ideas or comments, you can email us at erpodcast@foreignpolicy.com. Today, we're going to start off by talking about an article we published this morning called How the Trump Administration Broke the State Department, which, as you can guess, is a little bit about morale at foggy bottom, hitting rock bottom. And one of the things that we talked about when we were nearing publication is what was the correct headline of the article? Was it Tillerson broke the State Department or Trump broke the State Department? And I guess I wanted to start off with that question to Robbie and Dan, because we went back and forth on that and ended up with the Trump administration. So who is to blame for breaking the State Department? Is it Trump? Is it Tillerson? Or is it both?
Well, thanks, Sharon. Really appreciate it. Yeah, I mean, this piece comes from months of work, and we talked to over three dozen career diplomats, both current and former, including some sitting in this room right now. And what we've heard from a lot of them is it's a bit of both. It's Secretary Tillerson coming in and not really understanding how to navigate the bureaucracy, not really engaging with career diplomats on the one hand. And on the other hand, you know, President Trump came in looking to gut the State Department's budget, even as he boosted the military and Homeland Security's budget by extent. And also he and his team at the White House really looking to sideline career diplomats in the foreign policymaking process. And that's one of the reasons that we've heard that morale has really plunged at foggy bottom. But I'm sure we have some incredibly smart experts in the room who can lend their expertise and take on this from their vantage point serving at state.
This is Dan here. I'd weigh in that I think that it is both, but I would argue that it's ultimately the president and the White House. Because even if you had a new Secretary of State who had some different management approach, ultimately it's about the value that this president places on diplomacy. And I think we've seen now for 6 months that diplomacy sometimes doesn't have a place at the table. And I think the other aspect is that even when they do engage in diplomacy, the values and the ideas behind American diplomacy since World War II are being questioned or discarded. So the idea of cultivating and nurturing alliances with other democracies, the idea that America will speak out against backsliding in democratic terms or human rights abuses and so on. You have a kind of isolationist, America first, nativist streak running through this White House. And that also, I think, has unnerved many people who work in the State Department, and it's also unnerved U.S. allies around the world.
Well, Tom, you're quoted in the article as saying morale has never been lower. I mean, never lower over decades is certainly quite a comparison. What is the biggest factor driving that?
Well, over the 35 years of my association with the State Department, the reason I say it has never been lower is that it is not just one, but two factors occurring at the same time. One, a dismantlement of the budget, a discouragement of career officers to stay in the field, and disrespect for the daily work that they do. But in addition to that, a president who seems determined to jettison old alliances, to align himself more closely with dictators than with the democracies that have been the best friends of the United States. And while you may have had the first factor in previous administrations at times of budget stringency, you've never had these two factors occurring at the same time. That's why I say morale is lower than I've ever seen it.
Corey, we were talking offline just a few minutes ago, and you seem to say that some of this perhaps, I mean, maybe you can bring sort of a whole of government approach to this. Some of this is just Foreign Service whining. I mean, is that, do you see some of that here? I mean, do you see elements of truth there? What are your thoughts?
I actually do think that Foreign Service is really not helping its case by feeding stories. And by the way, Robbie, well done. Feeding stories about morale has never been lower, that it's impossible to do their jobs, that this is the end of the liberal order, because that actually reinforces the stereotype of the State Department as a place that views itself as superior to the elected officials of this country, as unwilling to figure out how to make whatever idiot Americans elect to run the country capable of doing what the voters of the United States elected them to do. And I also think it's important to realize that the State Department budget has gone up by a lot in the last 15 or 16 years. And so while I'm not advocating the 30% cut that the administration is trying to put in place, the State Department budget is not in the dire state that very often Foreign Service officers describe it. Moreover, in my judgment, the fundamental problems with the State Department are problems of institutional culture, not problems of financing. And let me just give you one example, which is that Secretary Powell, Secretary Rice, and Secretary Clinton all understood that the State Department was dramatically underinvesting in the professional development of its outstanding human capital. Each one of them added 1,000 additional Foreign Service officers to create what's called a training float, to create time in people's professional trajectories so that they could go learn more than they knew when they walked in the door. In all three of those cases, it never resulted in an additional training float because the Foreign Service chose instead to staff embassies with those people. So that's a choice. That's not the law of gravity. It's not, you know, a hostile administration shutting down the State Department. But even in those cases, the State Department chose to do what it likes to do, not what creates a stronger Foreign Service going forward. So just to close this out, I really think the State Department is doing itself a disservice by having a public conversation, which I think will A, not affect the Trump administration's choices, and B, not make people sympathetic to the State Department's problem, because they sound like they're just not getting with the program.
Right. Tom, I think you wanted to weigh in on that.
Well, yes, thank you. It is a good point about whining. And if the whining is coming from people inside the State Department, Corey is absolutely right. It will not change any minds in the White House. It will not change the point of view that public servants seem to be, according to the White House, people who are too stupid to make it in the private sector and worthy, therefore, of disdain. And I hate it when I see other responsible people in Washington whining about unfairness as much as our president does. But this article is primarily an accurate description of what is actually happening, and I think it is valuable for Congress, which ultimately will decide the budget of the State Department, to understand that there is both short-term and long-term damage being done to an institution that has been not a paragon of excellence, but has been one of the very best diplomatic services in the world.
Well, let's talk about, I mean, it's not even just the budget. There is, John, back in January, you wrote for Foreign Policy about the, quote, the catalog of unfilled senior positions includes a veritable who's who of the department's senior management. John, what happens when those positions are unfilled? I mean, you kind of gave a long list of them. What are the actual consequences on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, so I think there are a number of things you could point to in this regard. And, you know, I think it's notable that this has been something that's been on the radar since January. It hasn't remotely been addressed or resolved, which makes it feel, I think there was some question back then as to whether this was, you know, a new administration getting up to speed, maybe one that hadn't expected to win the election and was a bit behind the curve because of that, or something more deliberate going on. And I think now it's quite clear, given the number of months that have gone by, that this is a deliberate attempt to change the role of the State Department and of diplomacy in our foreign policy. I think there are two ways you can alter the role of an agency. One might be what the administration has done with EPA, where they install a leadership that is trying to kind of shift the agency 180 degrees from where it was and impose sort of new rules, new policies, new approach. The other is what they're doing at the State Department, which I would term more in the vein of kind of malign neglect. They have installed a leadership at the very top. They have not filled the middle and uppermost ranks of political appointees. And where that will have an effect is there are some big foreign policy initiatives this administration is trying to execute. They are trying to figure out a way to get North Korea to change its nuclear calculus. And there will be a military component of that strategy, forced posture in East Asia. There will be an economic component of that strategy, you know, putting ever more stringent sanctions on North Korea. But unless there's a diplomatic component of that strategy, it is hard to see how you get from these more coercive steps, which, you know, I think a lot of us support, to an outcome that might actually avoid what I think a lot of us believe would be a catastrophic conflict. And they do not have the people in place who can execute that strategy, who know the region, who know the players, and who can actually connect coercion to an outcome. And I would say the same goes for Iran, where you see also the administration ramping up increased pressure on the Iranian regime through the desire to impose new sanctions, some of which just were passed by Congress. They're undergoing a policy review that I think many of us expect is going to lead to recommendations of a tougher approach on Iran. And they're doing this at a time in which they are not even talking to the Iranian government at the highest levels. Now, there were people in the State Department who had relationships with the Iranian government even after the Obama administration left. And my understanding is those people have been told to sort of sever the connections that they had. And the risk there is that you have not a conflict or a confrontation that you choose, but unintended conflict or confrontation that results from misunderstandings because people are just not having basic conversations at high levels.
The Foreign Service has complained forever about the number of political appointees in the State Department, the way they crowd out the actual expertise of the building, which is the Foreign Service. And instead of saying, oh my God, it's the end of the world because we don't have political appointees that President Trump wants to put in place, the Foreign Service should view this as an opportunity to show that they can run the building without the, you know, used car salesman from Florida who politicians are always putting in place. We don't lack expertise on North Korea or Iran. That expertise resides in the professionals who are American diplomats. So I actually think the State Department could run better without political appointees if only they would take the bit in their teeth and show that they can do this.
If they could. I think both John and Robbie wanted to respond to that.
Well, so. Well, one of the things Dan and I found in our reporting is that these, you know, key positions that don't have appointees have acting assistant secretaries or undersecretaries or what have you now. The acting assistant or undersecretaries have complained to their colleagues that they just don't have the type of legitimacy or political clout, both in Washington and also talking to their foreign counterparts, because political appointees, they could be the used car salesman from Florida, or they could be an incredibly skilled veteran diplomat. Political appointee doesn't mean someone from the outside necessarily. And so I think that a lot of these actings don't have the clout of a president directly nominating them and then the Senate confirmation that these appointees would have. And as another counterpoint, I mean, Secretary Tillerson could appoint all these career, or President Trump could appoint all these, you know, skilled career diplomats into the into the official role instead of the acting role. And we haven't seen any of that. I mean, Secretary Colin Powell back in the day, he called his regional assistant secretaries his battalion commanders. And there's no battalion commanders in place now. So you have a general and you have a lot of, you know, lieutenants and sergeants and privates who are incredibly skilled, incredibly knowledgeable, but there's no one in the middle to help move the ball forward.
Yeah, I just add that I actually think, and this goes back to Corey's earlier comments, that she makes a lot of valid points, and a lot of what she said resonates with what, you know, I and I think other political appointees have found when we first got to the State Department. There is an inherent tension between political appointees and the career cadre. There is often some resentment, I think, and Tom, you know, can disagree with this if he does, but some resentment that relatively novice, relatively younger political appointees can come in positions of real authority and don't defer enough to the expertise of the Foreign Service. And I think that's something that every administration, every Secretary of State and their team have found. And the department is also not beyond the need for reform. I think anybody who claims that would be misleading people. It is not a perfect situation, and there is some bloat that should be addressed through the budget process. But I think if the Trump administration were saying, you know, what we really want to do is empower the people who have the expertise to give them some room to run and actually do their jobs and give them policy guidance and give them authority, and give the career cadre the opportunity to do exactly what Corey just described, which is show they can run the building. I think many of us would say that's an experiment worth testing, and maybe something actually that could lead to better performance from the State Department going forward. But I don't think that's anything like what we're seeing. In conversations with people who are still in the building, they don't feel empowered. They don't even really feel like they know what they're supposed to be doing day in and day out. And that to me is not exactly kind of doing the best they can to leverage the very real expertise and human capital that they have there.
I think both Corey and John are right that we Foreign Service officers have always grumbled about the number of political appointees, the same way that Army recruits grumble about the quality of food in the mess hall. It's part of the territory. It has never stopped Foreign Service officers from serving loyally whatever political appointee is in place and whoever the president is, and they are still determined to do the same. Corey is also correct that this is a time for both the Foreign Service and the civil service officers who are in acting assistant secretary positions to shine, to show what they can do. And I think they're doing that. I think in some ways the department is running better than when it has a full team. What is demoralizing and I think dangerous to American interests is the fact that the State Department, while it's running internally rather well, it does not have the influence either in policy formulation or in interactions with our partners that the U.S. has traditionally had. And that concerns me far more than the morale of any civil service or foreign service officer.
Well, right. I mean, this gets to two intertwined issues. One is the functioning of the State Department and what Tillerson is trying to do, good or bad, in terms of reforming the bureaucracy. But the other issue is the relationship between Tillerson and Trump. So we published an article about 11 or 12 days ago about how Trump was unhappy with Tillerson and with sort of being pushed, Trump felt, to recertifying Iran in the nuclear deal. And basically, Trump had ordered a group within the White House, within the National Security Council, to give him another option, i.e. to not certify Iran in 90 days. So what is, Robbie, the relationship right now between Tillerson and Trump? I mean, do the reforms even matter? Because it doesn't seem like Trump really wants to listen to what Tillerson or anyone in the department wants to say.
Yeah, I mean, Dan might be able to weigh in on this too. I think if there is a good relationship between Secretary Tillerson and President Trump, that doesn't filter down to the rest of the bureaucracy from everything I've heard. The secretary is, there's a lot of complaints that he's very detached, that he's very aloof. And he has this, circle, this small coterie of really close advisors around him, including his director of policy planning, Brian Hook, and his chief of staff, Margaret Petterlin, who more than one a career official has referred to it as the Praetorian Guard to Dan and I. And so, not a lot of career diplomats can crack through that wall. So if there is, good dynamic between the secretary and the president, which it appears that there's not, that there's some tension, but whatever benefits they have, it appears starts and stops on the seventh floor.
Yeah, I would weigh in too. Tillerson, I think by all accounts, does not have a very good relationship with the president in the end, and he's lost several arguments now. And one of them was on Qatar and this whole dispute between Saudi Arabia and the Gulf countries and Qatar. And I've had one foreign diplomat even tell me that when they get on the phone with the president, Trump openly says that he disagrees with his Secretary of State on how to handle this. So even when he's tried to kind of assert his authority and assert the State Department's role, he's lost out. And I think that whole episode around Qatar was very telling, because you basically had the U.S. government unable to articulate what its policy was, what it was trying to accomplish, with the president himself tweeting in complete contradiction to his own Secretary of State and his defense secretary. I think Tillerson has a pretty good relationship with the defense secretary. They seem to be on the same page quite a bit, and they communicate well. But yes, you have a situation, as Robbie said, where he's not able to exert influence in the White House. You have foreign diplomats now going to the White House and bypassing the State Department altogether because they feel like their phone calls aren't getting returned. You have a combination of Tillerson not able to exert influence inside the White House with the president, and then he also has a very flawed and dysfunctional relationship with his own rank and file inside the State Department, and it's not a good combination.
Let's talk a little minute then in earnest about the reforms that Tillerson is trying to do. I mean, from foreign service officers I've spoken with over the years, there's general agreement in the State Department. There's a lot to be said for reforming the bureaucracy. There are a lot of things that could be done better, some things that could be cut, but there needs to be a plan. I mean, is there something to what Tillerson is trying to do that makes sense? And talk about the survey. And what is a word cloud, by the way? I mean, so start with that. I mean, maybe, Robbie, tell us what is Tillerson trying to do? Where did the survey come into it? And is there anything good that could be done from this?
Yeah, well, my other colleagues might also weigh in. But essentially, Secretary Tillerson, when he came in, commissioned a survey by a small private management consulting firm that was sent out to all 75,000 State Department employees to try to gauge, you know, what their problems are they're experiencing in their day-to-day work. The secretary and his team called it a listening tour. And as part of that, there was a survey that was sent out that's a little bit infamous now in Foggy Bottom, where they asked, you know, career diplomats and civil service officers to help them build a word cloud. They asked questions like, what are the one or two things your office is doing that is redundant or unneeded? Which, you know, there is a lot of bureaucracy and red tape and redundancy, but some took umbrage with the premise of the question in that, you know, what we're doing is automatically there should be something that should be cut out. And that sort of set the tone for how Secretary Tillerson or how the foreign and civil service officers have viewed Secretary Tillerson. You know, they view this survey, which you know, might be good intentioned, as a bit of a Trojan horse for either undercutting the State Department or sidelining it or gutting its budget. And so while reform is good, the tone of it, particularly in the Trump administration, has really unnerved and rattled some diplomats that we've spoken to.
Yeah, I guess I'd just add that I think there are a lot of things actually that they are doing right in terms of seeking to reform the institution. It's good that they're rigorous, and I think, you know, you would expect that from Secretary Tillerson, who's managed an institution that is as large as the State Department. You know, Exxon has about 70,000 employees. The State Department has about 70,000 employees. Exxon's probably in almost as many countries as the State Department is. So this is an institution I think he can get his mind around in a way that previous secretaries maybe had a steeper learning curve there. I think it's right that there are no sacred cows in their review, that there is nothing they're saying is kind of off the table in terms of reforms that they're looking at. They're right to consult the employees of the institution in developing ideas, and they're also right to bring in, I think, an outside perspective, as kind of bad a name sometimes as consultants get in processes like these. But, you know, I think all of that in some ways is being overwhelmed by some very real problems in how they have conceived of this task. They have not made clear, certainly to the outside world, but I think to the building and the institution and the employees themselves, what the objective of these reforms is other than to shrink the institution. and then implicitly to diminish the institution by doing so. There is no clear policy agenda that is occurring sort of simultaneous to this. I think most people in the State Department would be hard-pressed to answer the question of what Secretary Tillerson's policy priorities are for diplomacy and for the institution. And, you know, there were two ways they could have gone about this. You know, this is akin to sort of fixing an airplane while it's flying. It's a very difficult thing to do. But instead of taking on that difficult task, what they seem to have done is sort of taken the plane, the institution, and put it in the hangar and taken people's work offline while they're going about doing the reforms. And I think that is a source of real frustration to some people. I think they would be much happier if they could go about their job and actually be conducting diplomacy while these institutional reforms are going on, and that does not seem to be the case.
So you know what I can't understand about what Secretary Tillerson is doing, which is that, as several people have said, like, most Foreign Service officers I know have an agenda about how they would like to change their institution and their profession. And even if you randomly picked one of these and put it into place, you could do it quickly, and you could do it in a way that improves the institution. What I cannot figure out, and leads me to wonder what the hell the secretary is doing, is this notion, as he testified during his budget testimony a few weeks ago, that the review will be conducted and not concluded until January of 2018. That is a recipe for institutional confusion, as folks are saying, for institutional ineffectiveness in the policy arena, and for the secretary to have a weak base of support as he goes about trying to do his job. Like, it makes no sense to me that he thinks the entire first year of his 4 years as the Secretary of State are to be spent on this, and only then will he nominate his senior staff. That's just, it makes no sense to me.
Well, of course, the other question, these rumors that have been floating lately of a Rexit, that Tillerson may not actually last. And certainly, it's hard to predict the future, but it does feel like there are aides around the president who are leaking these very negative stories about Tillerson. That can't be a good position for him. Do you think that Tillerson will last the next couple of years, or is that too hard to predict right now?
I think if Tillerson were to resign now, he would go down in history as the worst American Secretary of State, because he has neutered his department without fixing it. And he will leave saying, wow, math class is hard. It's frustrating being Secretary of State. And that's not news to anybody who's ever been Secretary of State.
Well, that leads me to a question about the other part of the article. This is to Robbie and Dan. I mean, this bulking up of the policy planning staff, what's behind that, and what are the effects of that?
From what I understand, I'll just be very brief because I'm sure John and Corey have a special expertise in this, since they were, in fact, policy planning director. But from what I understand, because Tillerson has no, you know, mid-level management, you know, assistant secretaries or undersecretaries to lean on, he's leaned very, very heavily on Brian Hook, his policy planning director. And Brian Hook is a pretty mainstream Republican who sort of cut his teeth in the Bush administration, advised on Romney's campaign, and was one of very few Republicans who refused to sign these Never Trump letters that circulated around Washington in the midst of the campaign last year. And so he came in as policy planning director, and he's de facto been Tillerson's right-hand man on everything, you know, accompanying him on trips, you know, doing a lot of the, you know, policy planning that a traditional policy planning office would do, but also, you know, a lot of the operational end of things that that his staff or that other bureaus around the office are doing. So Tillerson is sort of effectively walled himself off with a small group of advisors, and his top one is Brian Hook. And so, you know, expanding, they have plans to expand the policy planning unit, even double or triple the size. And a lot of diplomats worry that's sort of creating a department within a department, and will effectively shut out the rest of Foggy Bottom from Secretary Tillerson. But I'm sure John and maybe Corey have more on that.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly agree with what Robbie said. Look, my experience in policy planning was that office, which has a very interesting history going back to the period just after World War II and George Kennan, who set it up, is that it does three things that the rest of the building has trouble doing because its goals and its objectives are different. One is that the office has the time and the space to do some over the horizon thinking. It can take a step back from the kind of day to day fray and the near term crisis moments and think about where you want to be on big policies 3 months, 6 months, a year, 3 years down the road. Most people working in the federal government don't have that luxury. And it's very important that someone is doing that sort of thinking for a Secretary of State. The second is that policy planning can be what we call inside the government a red team. It can test unpopular ideas or ideas that run counter to the prevailing conventional wisdom either inside the State Department or inside the administration on policy and sort of do some thinking about a totally different approach and how that might work and the pluses and the minuses. And the third is it can be really laser focused on the core priorities of a given secretary, because it doesn't have to do everything. It doesn't have to also manage, all of the minutiae of important relationships with key countries. What policy planning should not do, at least in my view, is try to replicate or replace the basic work of maintaining relationships and managing policy that the bureaus carry out on a day-in, day-out basis. Nor should it be completely disconnected from those bureaus. I think policy planning works best when the people who are doing the long-term thinking are also in very close touch and coordination with the people who are managing the day-to-day relationships. And I think part of that is maintaining a number of career officers who serve in policy planning. When I was there, we had about a 50-50 split between career experts and political appointees in policy planning. And I think the risk of growing the size so dramatically and changing the focus is exactly what Robbie says, is that you give the impression, even if it's not the reality, that what the secretary actually wants is a miniature State Department of people he quote-unquote trusts, and then the rest of the building can sort of do what it does.
I just want to say that I absolutely agree with that. I think it's a terrific description of where policy planning adds value and what policy planning cannot substitute for that the rest of the department needs to do. Field Marshal Slim, during World War II, famously said that wars are not won on the small bodies of exceptional soldiers. They're won by the main force of an army. And the same thing is true with diplomacy. We actually don't need three smart people who can solve the problem. We need a legion of American diplomats who are out talking to the South Koreans, the North Koreans, the Iranians, the Germans, and who can consistently impart the messages of American diplomacy. And so to think that, seven smart people on the seventh floor of the State Department are the answer to this is a fundamental misunderstanding of the nature of how you advocate for America's interests in the world.
One of the things that's striking for me is if Tillerson stays, it doesn't seem like the relationship with Trump will get better. If Tillerson goes and Trump appoints someone that he gets along with better, it may just marginalize the State Department more, at least the Foreign Service officers. Tom, you're quoted in the article of saying that, your advice to Foreign Service officers was to do your best to stay and serve the American people until it becomes truly unbearable for you in a moral sense. And I sought to encourage them by reminding them that no administration lasts forever. The administration may not last forever, but it's probably going to last another 3.5 years. What do you think will be the long-term impacts on the department and on the Foreign Service officers?
I am more concerned about the long-term impact on American security and economic interests overseas than I am about the impact on the institution. And I think this administration can do a lot of damage to our traditional alliances and our image and influence in the world in the next 3.5 years. And that is as important, probably more important, as a source of the low morale in the department than the effect on individual careers. I think there could be damage to the department and to the quality and experience and qualifications of our Foreign Service officers and Civil Service officers, who are a larger group in the State Department than the Foreign Service officers in Foggy Bottom. That concerns me greatly. This is not a permanent blow to an institution that has seen ups and downs before. It is something from which the State Department, the Foreign Service, and the Civil Service in state and other agencies can recover, but it's going to be a very difficult 3.5 years.
Well, and on that optimistic note, we'll close it out for today. Please join us next time. And again, we love hearing from you. So if you have episode ideas or comments, you can email us at erpodcast@foreignpolicy.com. Tom, John, Corey, Robbie, Dan, we have a big group today. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Foreign Policy's The ER Podcast. I'm Sharon Weinberger, and I've been your host. The program is produced by Katie Gardner and Brandon Martini. For more information about FP and to subscribe to the ER and our Global Thinkers and Backstory podcasts, please visit foreignpolicy.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you very much for joining us.